Hello, and welcome to the first broadcast in our Traverse City Film Festival panel discussion series. Today, Being Elmo, A Puppeteer's Journey. We're about to meet the filmmakers behind this documentary about Kevin Clash, who gives life to Sesame Street's Elmo. On the panel, Kevin Clash, director and producer Constance Marks, producer Corinne LaPook, cinematographer James J. Miller, co-director, writer, and editor Philip Shane, and writer and director Justin Weinstein. Now here's moderator Ira Deutschman.
This should be a lot of fun. We're going to be exploring the creation of a documentary this morning. How many of you are Elmo fans here in the audience? Okay, well, that's, I think we'll have some fun. I want to start out, first of all, I'm Ira Deutschman. I am going to be moderating a number of these events here in Traverse City. Just thought I'd let you know that. We're going to start out by letting everybody on the panel here just introduce themselves briefly, starting all the way at the end, just a little bit of their background so you can get a sense as to where they all came from, and also what their roles were in the creation of this movie, because one of the things that you'll learn as we go on with this discussion is that the creation of a documentary film is an enormously complicated process, and I hope we can delve into that a little bit today. So why don't we start all the way on the end there.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming. My name is Justin Weinstein. My background is a mixture of independent documentaries and broadcast journalism. I had worked for ABC News and Peter Jennings, projects at PBS for many years, kind of at a producer level, at the filmmaker level. I guess Phil and I worked together on one of Peter Jennings' last documentaries. And after that, we always knew we wanted to work together and did some other things. And then finally, in the process, and I think you'll hear this story probably from all of us, but of how this film got made. But Phil had come on the project before me and then brought me in to help write and edit the film. And basically, the two of us on our laptops in our apartments in Brooklyn put the film together after most of it had been shot. There were a few more important interviews that were done, but I guess I was kind of the last in, but at a point at which the film was really nebulous, or we had just started reorganizing it from one thing into another. But I think that's my basic story. I'm New York-based, studied film at NYU, and have always loved documentaries. This is Phil.
Hi, I'm Phil. According to my name, I'm Philip Shane. Thank you all for having us here, by the way, too. We're just so excited to be here. Yeah, so as Justin said, you know, I kind of brought him in. I've been working in documentaries for like 25 years or so, and going all the way back, I started out, I'd gone to NYU and studied film, and then started working at Maisel's Films, where Connie had also worked, but just prior to me, and learned documentary from the beginning. And if you guys know, the Maisel's brothers made some of the greatest documentaries ever, and I was like, oh, well, that's a movie. That's how it, you know, a movie's made. And sometime after there, I got to work with Connie in 1996, I think. Connie made a film called Green Chimneys. Connie and James shot a film about kids in, I guess you could say, foster kids in a program in upstate New York, an incredibly powerful film. And I sort of was learning editing on that. And so I've known Connie since then. I went off and, like Justin said, I ended up doing television and film as well. And I had just done a documentary on Albert Einstein for the History Channel. And when it finished, Connie said, you remember that movie about Kevin Clash and Elmo that we've been filming for, at that point, maybe 4 or 5 years? She's like, do you want to come on board? And I was like, no, absolutely. And we ended up working on that for, it was, and then it was another 2 years after that. kind of took it. And it had begun as a verite film in the style of The Maisels, in a way, where we just went and filmed Kevin's life. And that there was a ton of amazing footage, but it was hard to find a single story. And what we found was that every time we told people about the project, the thing that was most powerful was Kevin's life story, what he would tell us, and we'd be like, oh, that's amazing. And so we sort of, when Justin talks about reshaping it, was that idea of turning it from somewhat of a more pure verite film into a biography mixed with a verite. And that's how it kind of became the film that it is. So, and then we wound up in Traverse City. God bless you. Thank you for having it.
Hi, everybody. My name's James Miller. I'm the director of photography, producer, cameraman for the project. Connie and I, husband and wife, we work on various projects together. And my background is over 30 years of being in the business of running cameras, shooting all around the world, shooting for BBC, all the networks, PBS, everywhere, and everything from documentary to sports to music, entertainment, and an occasional game show in New York. My background is how it all came about is I used to work on Sesame Street as a cameraman way back in the early 80s with when Frank Oz and Jim Henson were there on a fairly regular basis. And they were working at a beautiful studio at 81st and Broadway where I came in as in my early 20s. As a cameraman there, and I thought, wow, this is it, you know. I came from a small New Hampshire TV station, working freelance, doing these amazing jobs down in New York, and being on Sesame Street. So Kevin and I met on Sesame Street, and one day we were working together, and I brought my a photo album of our daughter Sophia. And it was she was a baby at the time, and I thought this would be kind of a fun project to put together and have Elmo and me going through the this little brag book of with Sophia, and I took the videotape back to Connie, and Connie was just like totally blown away. I'm with Elmo, you know, looking at this picture book with Sophia, and here's Sophia right down here. Who has joined us today.
Who's no longer a baby.
Yeah, we can thank for Sophia for putting us all together. but anyways, you know, Connie was just blown away by this puppeteer, this gentleman that did this favor for me. So she wanted to meet Kevin, and eventually they got together, had some lunch, over a four-hour lunch, I think it was, talking about various projects, and I think Connie was thought that there could be a really good story here. And so, you know, 6.5 years later, we're here at Traverse City. I mean, this is the greatest place. We're very, very happy to be here. And it was such a fun project. I wish I could continue a part two
to
this.
Tries to continue.
Yeah.
He wants to shoot Kevin all the time. James, we're done.
With his camera.
Kevin would like a little privacy.
So James,
now.
Yeah. You know, over. Like... It's over. It's over, James.
Yeah. But I don't know if any of you are camera people, but this is one of the best things a camera person could ever imagine is to get total access, full access to shooting, and to have your the subject be so comfortable with what you're doing that you just become a fly on the wall while you're shooting. And you're seeing it all happen in front of you, and I'm just rolling the tape, and I'm in total awe of this gentleman. Traveling the world with him, you know, we've been to South America, been to Paris, all around the country, and just meeting incredible people. So it was a lot of fun. I just felt very very honored to be a part of this.
Hi, my name is Connie Marks, and I produced and directed the film. I have to say that we want to thank Traverse City so much for having us here, but especially what an honor it is to have the whole team up here, because nobody's really ever asked us to do that. And this is, as you will see, and it's already been said, a total team effort. And so this is how it should be. This is how it should be all the time, but it unfortunately never is. So we thank you very, very much for allowing us all to be here and to describe for you our various roles in the project. I was one of those kids that my dad got me a movie camera. I had friends whose families were in the film business, and they were very encouraging, and I just always loved doing it as a hobby growing up, and then it turned into more than a hobby. I was either going to go to graduate school in social work. When it was time to apply to graduate school, I applied, and then I also applied for something called a youth grant from the NEH at the time. They gave a $20,000 grant to young people who had made a film. And I had made a film at that, by that point. And I got into graduate school, and I got the youth grant, so I had to decide what to do. So I decided I'd make films, but I'd try to incorporate what I cared about most, which was observing people and trying to understand more about people's motivations for doing things, and which I think was what led me to think I wanted to go to be a social worker. So long story short, I make films that seem like they're probably made by a social worker, but they're hopefully a lot more entertaining than sitting in a therapy session with a client. But I just thank you again for having us here, and feel free to ask any questions whatsoever. And this is Corinne LePook, our wonderful producer. And I just want to say also that Corinne's father was my dentist when we were growing up.
Yeah, that was one of the only things I had to say.
Oh, then I'll let you say the other one. They said everything about measles and how we got on the set and meeting Kevin and all that. I had nothing to say either, so now it's balls in your courts.
I also want to say about Sophia that I think it's remarkable that this film has taken up over half of her life, because she's 12, and it's taken, I think, almost 7 years now to make the film. I had a totally different background than everybody else. I've never worked in documentary films before. After college, I worked at CBS, and then I worked at MTV. I was part of the original team at MTV. Back when nobody knew what it was, like you had to explain, it's like music, but you see it, it's TV, and nobody had any idea what it was. And that's actually going to be 30 years old next week, so it's pretty amazing. After that, I worked for a music marketing company. We represented video directors and some bands. And then I worked for the American Film Institute in New York, and I ran their office there for about 6 years. And then I had my second son, and I decided to move. We live in New York, to move out of Manhattan and moved to the suburbs, and I actually didn't work for about 10 years. I raised my two sons. And Connie called me. We were in film class together in eighth grade. We go way back. And she said my dad was her dentist. And she said, will you consider going back to work, and do you want to produce this with me? And I wasn't sure, because I already had left the working world, and I said, what's it about? And she said, it's about Kevin Clash and Elmo. And I said, definitely, because I love Jim Henson and the Muppets and Kevin and Elmo and Sesame. So it's just been terrific, and it's been wonderful, and thank you for having us.
Excuse Elmo, he didn't wash Elmo this morning. Okay, he works for Elmo. That's all we're gonna say. Okay, that wasn't that funny.
Listen, a long story short, because you'll see it in the documentary. Started at a very young age in Baltimore, Maryland. In the Dundalk area of Baltimore, Maryland. And had phenomenal, still have phenomenal parents, and a wonderful family base of brothers and sisters. We all had our own vision, our own direction that we wanted to go, and mine happened to be with puppets. And so it's been a wonderful unbelievable ride. I never thought this would happen. Started building puppets at 10 years old. I remember because of the toy, of course, the Tickle Me Elmo. And what was interesting, as you guys said, the doc that you did, it came out in 1996. Of course, that was the same year that Tickle Me Elmo hit and came out. But it's like I said, it's been a wonderful ride. It's taken me around the world and working with Jim and all those wonderful genius of puppeteers like Frank and Dave Gulls and Jerry Nelson and Richard Hunt, the late Richard Hunt, who I love dearly, who actually you'll hear about in the doc. He gave me this little red monster. So again, I know how to do sound bites, so I won't drag this out. But it's been a wonderful ride, and I'm definitely glad to be here. Got to meet Michael Moore at the airport day before yesterday. Well, yesterday, wasn't it? Yesterday. So it was wonderful to meet him, and I'm hoping to meet him tomorrow. I already told him that I thank him for inviting us here, and I hope you enjoy the film.
I want to spend a few minutes now, really talking a little deeper about the process of making a documentary film. And we're living in an age now where everybody in the world is a filmmaker. Everybody with a cell phone, at least, is a filmmaker. And there's a temptation to just point a camera and think that you've got a real film there. And as we all know, making a really good documentary is much, much more than that. So I want to try to follow the process a little bit. First of all, starting with those of you who were there at the inception, the idea, part of it is finding something that you believe is going to be a story. Because when you start shooting a documentary, you really have no idea where it's going to actually go. So I'd like you to just talk a little bit about, what was it that made you feel like there really was a story to make it into a documentary?
Well, James came home from Sesame that day with the VHS, and I looked at it. We've had it transferred to DVD now, and I think when we make the DVD of the film, I want to include that as part of the extras because it was so cool. But I saw that, and I was intrigued. Who is the man behind this? And when we finally met for lunch a couple of weeks later, meeting Kevin gave me the confidence, and hearing his story and seeing his ease with which he was telling it, but hearing the genesis of his story was really a big part of what made me feel like there's really something wonderful here that we could, focus on. I didn't think it would be for 7 years, but yeah.
And I would imagine that the next step in that process was convincing Kevin to allow you that kind of access.
You know, I don't know if I'm foolish or what, but I thought the fact that he agreed to meet with me was the first hurdle, and then because he knew James or had a familiarity with James, I think there was a bit of trust there. And then we either got him Green Chimneys or he had seen Green Chimneys, the film that Phil and James and I made with Bob Eisenhart. And I think at that point, Kevin was okay with it.
What happened is, I just come off of writing a book called My Life as a Furry Red Monster. And it was a lot of fun to go back and reminisce about where the origins of me being a puppeteer came from. And so it was really interesting. And there was no room for pictures in the book. And then when Connie talked to me about this, I thought, well, this is the next step, to show visually what was in the book as far as the excitement and the love that I've had over the years as far as with puppets and all of the wonderful mentors I met to get me where I'm going. So it was the next step, and so I thought it was a wonderful. Also, the challenge for me now being in this industry with puppets is seeing how popular like Pixar is as far as computer-generated 3D, and how there was no movies coming out of the Muppets anymore, and really wanting to keep everybody interested and loving what we do. And so that was another reason to talk about it and also celebrate it through a documentary. And also talk about my love and my enjoyment of working with Jim over so many years. And So that's why, you know, I really decided to say, yes, this is something I'd like to do.
And did you have any concerns or things that, you know, limitations that you wanted in, to put on it in terms of?
Well, because I'm not, I mean, you know, I'm not seen, you know, that was kind of the challenge to me. But again, like James was talking about, once I get into doing what I'm doing, I don't, you know, all of that goes, because it's not about me. Mm-hmm. It's about creating the character with this hand. So that, but also just personally, you know, it was more about what I do than the background of my family and stuff like that. As far as I wanted to talk about the specifics of how my parents helped me and also the challenges I had with having a child and stuff like that through this, because I was all over the place and all over the world all the time. So those are the things that I wanted to talk about. And of course, the all of the enjoyment of all of the years, because I started when I was 10, you know, doing this.
You're listening to a panel discussion from the Traverse City Film Festival on IPR News Radio. The panel, the filmmakers of Being Elmo, A Puppeteer's Journey.
So did any of you have concerns about, like, peeling back the magic by showing, you know, Kevin standing underneath that puppet?
Well,
I think, you know, when I was working on Sesame Street as a cameraman, I feel so fortunate to see them actually making the product, you know. I mean, I'm just taking the pictures, but the puppeteers are sitting in an uncomfortable position while they're reading the script, while they're working the puppet and the arms at the same time, looking at a monitor that's completely reversed of what their brain is. You know, supposedly doing. Everything's right, left, right, you know, opposite. And that just blew me away to see that. And I thought it would be wonderful for the audience to see behind the scenes the making of how it's actually done and how difficult it is. And these guys do it every day so
did
perfectly.
Did you feel worried that you were going to be exposing something that shouldn't be seen? I mean,
not really. I mean, there's a play out on Broadway, Avenue Q, where you actually see the puppeteers working the puppets, and you actually, I think it's fine. I think it was great to see the puppeteers working, because even if you see them working, your eye still goes to the puppet.
You see humans all the time. Yeah. We see them. Sometimes we don't want to see them.
Yeah.
So when you're seeing something different, that's where your eye goes to, you know, the unusual, the difference. So it's really interesting about that, you know, as far as concerned about that. It's so funny. I try to tell celebrities come into Sesame Street and they say, oh, I don't know if I should bring my children because I don't want them to see behind. You know, I always say to them, they keep their imagination for long as they want, and I tell them. Even when an adult comes in to Sesame Street and they see Big Bird, or they see even behind the scenes of it, they turn into a four-year-old. You can see it, you look in their eyes, it's this whole glow that happens, and forget about it, it's gone. You know, for a certain amount of time, I mean, you would also say, oh no, I'm talking to the puppet. It's like, you know, they stop themselves. You know, they're having this conversation. It really does not. When children come to the show, we have sometimes, you know, visitors and stuff like that, and I'll go and get Elmo and I'll go bring Elmo out, and they don't know me, they don't care to know me. They run to that character, they hug that character, because that's who they see. They see their friend on TV, and now they get to see him in person. Now sometimes, when the child sees Elmo in person, it is the scariest thing for him, because they're so used to seeing him through the TV. And the parent doesn't understand it. So the parent's like, this is your favorite character. Go up, and they're pushing the child, and the child is screaming bloody murder. Now it's like reverse. It's like, I have to explain to the parent, listen, this is very different medium for him. Let them, if they're not ready, you know, let them go and watch other kids and how they react, and then they come around. But it's a different medium. It's a wonderful thing to see kids. I am carrying their friend And that's the way they, and that's all they see me as, is a friend carrying their, that somebody who they love and they want to see.
Whereas now we know that actually Delmo's carrying you.
Yes.
Yeah. I just want to add real quick. That,
very manipulative. Yes.
Yeah. There's another weird, another funny aspect of why you look, at least for me, why I looked at the puppet more. I got to interview Kevin once, and then I thought I was really clever. Same idea that everyone who interviews Kevin says. I said to Connie, I was like, do you think I could interview Elmo at the end? Would he bring? She's like, yeah, try it. But she's like, it's not easy interviewing Elmo. And I was like, come on. What's a big deal? So Kevin, you know, graciously brought out Elmo. And so I'm saying, oh, wow. So there's Kevin, you know, big man, and there's Elmo right there. And I look at Elmo, and, you know, I ask a question, and Elmo starts answering the question. It's fine. And I glance over at Kevin. And he's making, when he's doing Elmo, he's making all these faces, and this voice is coming out of his mouth, and it's very disturbing. And your eye goes right back to the puppet. And you're like, oh, that's, Elmo. Yeah.
And very embarrassing for me, because I'm not thinking about that at that point. So when I see it, it's like, oh my God, that's the way I look performing it.
I think that when we see reporters, you know, like investigative reporters, they are doing an interview with the Muppet, okay? So they're going back and forth with the banter, and there's Kevin down there and the puppet here, and they move the mic from them
to the puppet,
right to the puppet. You see how it goes more like. So
no, I used to do, or I used to be on Captain Kangaroo, and. Gus Allen Gretti, who was amazing puppeteer. He performed Mr. Moose and Bunny Rabbit. He was amazing puppeteer. And he told me once he was behind the counter where, you know, Mr. Moose and Bunny Rabbit is, and they had a new floor manager. And the floor manager is the one that counts down and says, okay, action, you know. And so he's behind the counter, and the floor manager's on the other side, you know, by the cameras, and he's never worked with puppets before. So he's counting, but then before he says action, he just points. And he's pointing to Mr. Moose and Bunny Rabbit. And in his ear, the director's saying, what is going on? Why is he not saying anything? He said, I don't know, I'm cueing him. Finally, Gus gets up and says, you need to come back here and cue me. I can't see you from there. You know, it's this illusion that people really connect to, they get into. And that's the fun of it. It really is the fun. I mean, I was so backwards growing up. I was so shy. If my mom would tell me to go to a store, a grocery store, I would... You know, if I saw people coming, I'd go around them and wait for them to go around me and go. And, you know, performing these characters got me out of that, fortunately. You know, now I can talk and I can communicate without having a puppet on. But back then, I couldn't do that. When I would get shows, you know, I would negotiate with the puppet on. And say, well, you know, he wants $50, you know, for the two of them. And, you know, the puppet would look at me, is that what you need? Yes, yeah.
Okay, so
Ira, I think Kevin needs to tell everybody about meeting President Obama.
Oh,
because
goodness,
from
I can't believe I'm still sitting here after I met him. I was we normally do the Easter egg roll every year, the cast, two or three of the cast and the Muppeteers, and normally I, you know, but last 2 years, or something like that, Michelle would come down with the kids, with the girls and stuff like that. And normally the president would come down and do a read. He would read a story, and then he would go back up, and then Michelle and the kids. Well, this time he came the rehearsal day before the Easter egg roll. And so he took pictures with us, and Elmo was right there on his shoulder, and Elmo ate his face. Elmo just, you know, was like right there. But that's what I do to everybody. I mean, I thought, you know. So that was my instinct because that's what I do. And he walked away, kind of, you know, like, what was that about? And he said to Michelle, "Yeah, he is mischievous, isn't he? You know, blah blah blah." I said all this stuff, and And then I went back to the hotel. I said, I can't believe I've done that. So they probably won't let me in here tomorrow. And so I saw Michelle the next day, and I said, Michelle, you know, was that? Oh, she said, yeah, we're going to blow that picture up and put it right in the bedroom. You know,
Meanwhile, the Secret Service probably had their like, fingers on the trigger.
It's, like, yeah, it's him. It's him. It's him. It's him. It's him.
But they, I mean, you can see that they all have a wonderful sense of humor, and we had a great time being there. So it was a lot of fun. And I'm, like I said, I'm not in jail somewhere. I'm actually here in Traverse City to talk to you guys about it. So.
And you weren't there with the camera for this, huh? It's,
he tried.
Yes. I missed that one. But I'm sure Secret Service was all over it.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just to say, James found out that Elmo was going to NASA, and like 12 hours before you left to go to NASA, James was like, can we call Kevin and ask if I can go? I said, no, it's done.
So how much footage did you end up with, all told?
Wow.
Just under 200 hours.
200 hours.
Something. Yeah, which is not, I mean, that's...
That's nothing.
Yeah, right. That's not...
Maisel's would have 1,500.
Well, I mean,
loads
it's
of archival.
It's as much as I ever want to do, because it just slows down the editing process.
Yeah. And, I'm actually curious about the archival footage. I mean, there's some stuff in the movie where it's amazing that there
Has
was...
Has anybody seen it yet here?
Okay. Yeah, you're all going to get to see it this afternoon,
oh,
I
you
hope.
Saw it? You saw it?
Yeah. So, I mean, the archival footage of you as a young person doing all this stuff, who was there to document
Well, Kermit
that?
Love was one of my mentors that I met early on in my teens, who actually helped design and build a Snuffy and Big Bird for Sesame Street. He has a wonderful background. He worked with George Balanchine over so many years doing costumes and stuff, and so... Him and Jim got together, and so I saw him on this children's program called Call It Macaroni that was on PBS, and what it was is that it would have a young boy and a young girl that would go and spend a day with somebody in a profession. Mm-hmm. And I happened to see this one where Kermit was there. They went to his shop, they built and everything, and I said to my mom, I wanted to meet him. Lo and behold, my senior year, I went up to New York, and prior to that, my mom got on the phone with the local PBS station and found his number, called and said, listen, my son would really like to talk to you. And he said, well, and whenever he's in town, you know. So I went up for that senior year, I got to meet him. He said they already cast for Sesame Street that year, because he said, you know, I had 8x10s of my characters, because I'd already done 2 local television shows, so I had a tape, and he saw it, and he was very impressed. And he said, but I will keep you in mind for some other things. And lo and behold, we got to know each other. I came up and did some things. And this show called Big Blue Marble, which was this wonderful show that showcased young kids doing, you know, things at a young age, a profession already. And they called him and they asked him, did you know of a young puppeteer that we could interview with you? And he said, well, I just happen to know someone. And he asked me, would I be interested in doing it? And what was really cute at the time is, I think I must have been like 17, and you know, I had a little bit of peach fuzz, you know, it was like, and he said, but you're gonna have to shave because they really, you're a little older than they would normally use for this. And I was so proud that he actually saw the peach fuzz, you know, that he actually noticed that I was growing some hair. And I actually got to do Big Blue Marble. It was a wonderful film crew. I'd love to find them somewhere that went down, came down to Baltimore and shot me for 2 days, and then brought me up to New York and shot me with Kermit and building a puppet and stuff like that. And they did a wonderful job, and that was what it is. I mean, Connie can tell you the challenges, and Corinne can tell you the challenges as far as trying to find that.
Well, it was an interesting journey. Kevin told Connie about it. Sorry, Corinne. Kevin told Connie about the show, and she started to track it down, and she found the person who was, shopping it around, and she said she got a tape of it, and said she was going to get back to him when she knew what she wanted to use. And of course, a good amount of time went by, and she called him back, and unfortunately, he had passed away. and his company was gone. There was no record of him. We tried everything for, I think it was about 2 years. Connie and I called everyone. We found out the name of his wife. She went to my college. I called the alumni office. I mean, we were just trying everything. And after about 2 years, we found the source, a big company that had ended up owning the footage. And I remember calling the person. We finally had the name of the person who had the footage, and I was so excited. And when I said, do you have the Big Blue Marble masters? We were looking to get permission and the master tapes. And he said, yes, I had the Big Blue Marble tapes. I had the masters, but I just threw them all away. And so not only Kevin's show, but I think there was one on Christy.
Yeah, oh, there was beautiful,
a whole series.
I mean, beautiful series of all these wonderful footage of kids. It was amazing.
Yeah.
And I was heartbroken because I would have loved to have got a copy of all of them. It would have been great.
I was literally shaking, as you can imagine. I used to work for AFI, which is so big in film preservation, and I, you know, started giving him a lecture, like, how could you throw away a piece of our history? And he's like, well, we didn't have any need for it, so I just threw it away. But we were able to get permission to use it, and so Connie preserved the only memory of it.
Yeah, I, just a quick aside for those of you who are not aware of the need for film preservation. My office in New York is in the Duarte Laboratory Building, and Duarte, which was one of the oldest, longest-lasting film labs in New York, recently went out of the film processing business, and they are literally trying to find the owners of all the negatives of the films that are sitting there. And they, you know, if they can't find them, they're just going to throw them out because they don't know where to put them. They, you know, it's a fascinating and a major problem that we all have to face in terms of preserving all this stuff. Going back to the process for just a minute, let's talk about the editing for a moment. You alluded to the fact that it was a difficult process, and one of the reasons why it took so long to get the film finished. Can you talk a little bit about that process? You know, what it's, I mean, for those of you who are not aware of this, one of the common things that people talk about in terms of documentaries is how they're actually written in the editing room. That you have all of this footage available to you, and then you've got to shape it somehow into a story.
Yeah, and this was a really unusual.
Well, before Phil came on, I just want to say, because when he was available, I did like a touchdown dance and like, you know, I'd been waiting for him for years and he wasn't available. And I went through two other sets of editors and that was really painful. And we were trying to, make like a, you know, a stone house out of straw. Or I don't know, you know, it was just, we were trying to do something that was not going to happen. And I'll let Phil and Justin fill in the blanks. But
also Connie, you know, with Connie going through this and trying to find the right editors, she was showing me stuff, and I was like, what did I get myself into? Because, and I can tell her that now, because it's fabulous. It's wonderful.
I knew.
It's great
I knew.
Piece.
I was writing
but,
Kevin
Lake. I did not let on to her, but I was really concerned because I did not know. We talked about what it was, but we were still in the process. You were still in the process of trying to find the direction to go. But as I was looking at it, I was like, "Wow, what is? I don't know what this is. What is this representing?"
And just before Phil and Justin take off with this, I was just so upset that, you know, Kevin was so patient in hanging in there with us, and I really knew that it was not that you were not, you know, please, because I wasn't, I mean, I wouldn't put my name on stuff I was showing you. So I was writing Kevin letters, emails saying, please be patient, hang in there with us. You know, we will get this figured out. And he was such a gracious and patient subject. So I always feel gratitude.
But she was always very respectful. You were always very respectful to the editors. You know, I never knew that she was having concerns until Phil and Justin came in.
Until the White Knights.
Because then I could see the difference. I could really see the difference. And then it excited me to be more involved with giving them things because then I knew what they were doing.
Right. So the real great trick, I guess, with anything you do in life, but especially if you're a documentary film producer, is to surround yourself with, you know, people who excel in any given area in which you're hiring them to work. So be it DP or the editors or music or whatever, you just surround yourself with the A-team and your life is going to be a lot easier. And the A-team eventually became available to us in year four, and I'll let you...
Year four. Yeah, and I just want to say it was such an interesting, you know, the most difficult projects are also the most interesting and ultimately the most rewarding. One of the editors, in fact, had been a student of mine, in fact, a really good, I also teach editing, and he's a really good friend of mine and a really great student, and he was having a lot of trouble with it. And anyway, eventually Connie brought me in and I came on board and continued to try to make the movie that they were making. And we all come out of this verite background, if you don't, right? That just means generally no, you know, limited interviews, but you go and you just film life as it happens. And then you edit that into a story. It's the riskiest, hardest thing in the world. One of the reasons that reality television, I think, is so kind of poor, so kind of bad, is that it's... The networks don't have the time to just send people out and film life and shape it. It takes a long time. It's very hard, and often it doesn't come together. There wasn't a single thing. If Kevin had been involved, let's say, I don't know, in some single thing that we could have watched progress, have his ups and downs, we would have done that. But that isn't what, you know, Kevin does so many different things. So anyway, I came on board. We looked through all the footage. I kind of started making that movie. And being trained as a verite editor, our job is to take footage and shape it and find that story. And to not do that is a terrible failure. I just felt awful. And I had, you know, at that point, many years of experience. And then, you know, you're like, uh-oh, I lost it. You know, what is going on here? And finally, you know, boy, it was tough. It was tough for all of us, really tough. And I finally, you know, I think Connie and I sort of had a moment of just like, well, we had many moments of, should we stop? Can we stop? No, we can't stop.
They didn't tell me that.
Yeah, we... Like, that's this guy...
Four years of running around for him.
This guy ain't cutting it. I mean, you know, if it was just the puppet, maybe, but...
I would say Connie never gave up, ever, from what I saw.
I didn't, but I was, like, on the ledge a few times. James dragged me in.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, it's more as a rhetorical device to say, well, no, what do we do? How do we... What is another direction that we haven't thought of? And the weird thing is I had this kind of odd career where I'd done verite film, and then I'd also done historical documentaries, which are narrated. I'd done things for ABC, History Channel, that kind of thing. And we said, look, I know how to do that, I think. So let's sit Kevin down and, like we said, tell his life story and have him tell us his life story. And we spent a long time researching and doing that, and sat Kevin down for long, long interviews to the point where, you know, he'd be like, "Guys, I gotta," you know.
But you know, I can tell in certain places where, because I know myself, where the interviews were trying to give you something, but still not knowing what you guys were doing. To the last interviews where I knew exactly what you guys were doing, and you could see it with the way I talked about it. Fortunately, we went back and talked about a lot of the things that you needed for the whole film. So most of those interviews where I did not know what the documentary was going to be and was concerned about it, we didn't use most of that. That was good. I mean, once I knew, then I could get more excited and then give them more to use for the film.
I mean, it's interesting, you guys haven't seen the film yet, so when you go, here's a little trick. You'll see that, you know, the interviews take place in different places, and yeah, largely a lot of it comes from that latter interview where we all understood it.
You're listening to a panel discussion from the Traverse City Film Festival on IPR News Radio. The panel, the filmmakers of Being Elmo, A Puppeteer's Journey.
There was one other, another just real quick key moment was that time where we decided we had to shift gears and do a biography. I stayed up all night and we wrote this whole long thing. We're going to meet with Kevin. We're going to explain, okay, that whole thing you've been seeing, we're going to do a totally different thing. And here's why. And this is what we're going to need from you. We're going to need you to really give us your perspective on your life, because that's not what we weren't getting. We were just seeing you. We were so nervous. And you came over for breakfast or whatever it was. And you said, guys, before you even start, here's what I think. I think you need my perspective. And I was just like, phew, that's done. And then later you made us crab cakes, and that was all wonderful. I have to bring in Justin here, too. So I then worked on it for, God, I don't know, a year.
See, whatever, you can get anybody, if you make them crab cakes.
Yes.
You can get anything from anybody if you make good crab cakes.
You had us at crab cakes.
So I worked for more than a year then doing that, trying to take those interviews, shaping them, and Connie and I would go back and forth. And we got it to a certain point. It was coming together, but it was like never going to get done. And I had worked with Justin for a number of years over at ABC, and then, you know, brought him on board.
And I said, well, Elmo, I kind of an irritating character. I grew up before Elmo. Yeah, I'm
this for the first time.
And then I saw him.
He's a Ferlinghetti Donizetti fan.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Something's wrong
Book
with
and
you.
Brook. No, I grew up pre-Elmo with, you know, the original Sesame Street in the early 70s. B.E., yes. And, no, it didn't take me long from seeing the footage to really be charmed by both Elmo and Kevin. But, and Phil, too. We're both of the same generation. So, you know, at first, we didn't have that connection. And we developed it kind of remotely by seeing everything that you were doing and everything that was filmed. But I don't really come out of the editing world. I'm generally more of a director-producer. And so I saw what Phil wanted to do in terms of turning it into a story and finding, you know, smaller dramatic arcs within this bigger history. And what, getting to your question, Ira, I think what a huge part of the struggle for us was to take all of the beautiful Verite footage that they had shot and find ways to use it to illustrate different points of either Kevin's life or his craft. And so I think you'll see when you see the film that, you might find yourself in Paris watching him train other puppeteers, but these Verite scenes are where they are for a reason that becomes apparent, whether it's him working with a Make-A-Wish child who, you know, a dying child whose last wish is to meet Elmo. There's all this fabulous footage and so much more than is in the film. But we really had to be extremely judicious in saying, well, does this have a place in the story? Or, you know, is it just a great thing that takes us off in a tangent? And, you know, this is something we call killing our babies, where, you know, there's a great scene and everybody loves it, but, you know, you don't know how to get back from that scene into the main storyline. And I think that was a huge part of our, you know, banging our heads against the film to try and really make it move forward like a freight train and not get off track.
So could we ask Elmo a question?
Sure. He just got clean, so that's why I'm trying to keep his fur down a little bit.
What's your name?
What's my name?
Yeah, what's your name?
My name's Ira.
Hello, Mr. Ira. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Where are you from?
New York.
Cool. Elmo's from New York, too.
I knew that.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Now, what's the question?
Well, last night, I...
Hi. How are you? Nice yellow shirt. It says Michigan 2004. Is that when you were born? No. Go ahead, sorry.
Okay, that's all right. Last night I tweeted out...
You got it? Good. Oh, sorry. You wear any socks? Okay, sorry. No, go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead.
You know what? I think I'm going to open up the floor for questions.
Go ahead. Come on. Go ahead.
I'm just wondering, who is your favorite Sesame Street character that you work with?
Big Bird.
Why is that?
Because he's taller than Elmo, so he helps Elmo reach up real high for things.
Good answer.
There's a motivation to a friendship like that. No, Elmo loves...
Are you... Excuse me.
You okay?
Yes, thank you.
Yes, Big Bird. But Elmo's first best friend is Elmo's goldfish, Dorothy.
Really?
Yeah. She's so smart. She She really is, Miss Connie. She's always laughing at Elmo. Elmo can be serious sometimes, Miss Connie.
So, yeah, I'm sorry, Elmo, can I ask Kevin a question?
If you must.
I mean, how is it that you can think in two dimensions like that, where you're...
That started at a young age. I was 10 years old, and I didn't get it from anybody. We had a floor television, a big floor television, and there was a mirror up above the TV, and so I would sit there with the puppet, watch TV, but I could look up at the mirror and see if I was keeping the puppet alive. And I did that at the age of 10. I was really young, and so I was already learning how to, to make a puppet look real to a certain extent.
Yeah, I mean, even as you're talking, he's like,
Yeah, well, that's the part of the illusion.
Yeah. No, I know. So, let's have some questions from the audience. I think we have some microphones that are going to come around so that everybody can hear the questions.
Oh, isn't that special?
I was wondering, how do people react when you tell them that you are Elmo, technically?
I was at Sesame Street once, and we had a visitor come in, and she came up and she said, "I can't believe that you perform Elmo." I said, "Yeah." And she did this like 6 times. I can't believe. Okay, well, what's the problem here? you see me puppeteering it? No, but she was just so shocked about it and sweet. But for the most part, I mean, people have their idea of what the puppeteer should look like, which is really funny, So I don't look like that person.
Kevin tells us the story that he was on a plane once, and he was asked to...
What was really sweet is I was on a plane, and I was marking up a script for Sesame Street, and this stewardess came over and said, "What do you do on Sesame?" And I said, "Well, I direct and perform Elmo." "You do Elmo?" And we were close to getting ready to taxi, and so she said, "Could you say something to," because there was a lot of kids on the plane, "could you go up and say something to the kids on the plane? Just tell them, it's time to, buckle up. It's, they're going to be taxiing really soon." And so I went up and said, "Hello, this is..."
"Elmo from Sesame Street, please buckle up. We're going to be taxiing soon, and Elmo loves you."
And that's what I did. So everybody in the aisle bent. And of course, I come out. And they're like... Thank the Lord for anonymity.
We were shooting on the set of Emeril, and I guess Kevin and Elmo are guests there all the time. And before the show was starting, they were all getting ready on the set with the kitchen and prepping everything, and Connie was there, and I was there getting ready as well. And we started hearing like Barry White singing, over the PA. And Connie's saying to me, Who is that? We're trying to look around. Nobody is singing. But there's somebody underneath the table doing it. And, do you remember that?
It sounded Sinatra, actually.
Because the band started playing Doc.
What was the song?
I don't even know. But the band started playing, and it was a lot of fun. I love singing. So it was me.
It was Kevin's voice, I love singing. Oh, my God. It was so gorgeous.
No, that's what I love about Sesame Street. I mean, all the songs that we get to sing, because that's a part of. I mean, when I was going to high school, I did all the musicals and stuff like that. So it's a lot of fun. And I grew up with Motown and, all these wonderful musicians that my mom and dad had records of and stuff. So it's always fun. That's another enjoyment that I have about Sesame Street. And also getting to sing with so many different people. I mean, doing Bowie, with Labyrinth, David Bowie was involved, and he did a lot of the songs for the show, and so I got to sing some songs that he had done, and it was wonderful meeting him. And one of
the most touching moments is the memorial, Jim Henson's memorial.
Sure.
And the puppeteers were on stage at the memorial and did a piece, and it just tears you apart. I mean, it's so touching.
If just one person believes in you. That's all I'm going to sing.
But it's a beautiful song. That's actually from the Peanuts. The musical The Peanuts called If Just One Person. And it was one of Jim's favorite songs. One thing that Jim did, and you'll hear about this in the doc, is that he left letters to all of his children, but then he left a letter to the puppeteers before he passed away. And he put these letters away 4 years ago before he passed. And the one that he left to us was, I'm gone at my funeral. I don't want anybody to have black on. I want everybody to have color. I want a Dixieland band to be there. No dirge. I don't want a dirge. And he said, and you got to abide by it. I'm gone. You have to abide by what I said. So we did, and everything was festive. One thing that he enjoyed doing is recordings, pre-recording songs with everybody. And so we did that on the stage at the church, and it was a lot of fun. We all did a lot of his favorite songs, which were very vaudevillian songs, like Lydia the Tattooed Lady, that he did on the show with a pig that had these tattoos all over her body, and Scooter sang the song. So we did all of his favorite songs, and one of them was definitely If Just One Person. Any other questions? Sorry, yeah, right back there. Oh, I'm sorry, Mike.
Hi. You've been on for a long time, like since the 80s, right?
I started Sesame probably 85, yeah.
And
I'm sorry. Started in 81 and then came back to it in 85.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Thank you.
Well, I know that you've changed hands with writers for a while.
Wow. There are a lot of writers. Yeah, back and forth, sure.
Yeah, have you ever had any sort of problems with writers? Like, you have a good idea for your character, and you think that Elmo would do something different than the writer has written. Have you ever had any problems with that?
Not really. The show has been... not really, which is surprising. Sometimes they want Elmo to say I. Sometimes, but that's in a song, and I'm like... I can't do it. I could do it. I could say I, but I can't get him. But that's sometimes a challenge, so he won't do it.
All right, I think we're unfortunately out of time.
Sorry, we talked too much. We should have had
you guys talk. That's okay. Yeah, thanks. Thank you guys for being here in Traverse City.
Thank you.
We just get started, and before you know it, comes the time we have to say, Elmo has no ears. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, everybody.
You've been listening to a panel discussion from the Traverse City Film Festival. IPR News Radio will air all of the panels in the festival. Visit ipr.interlaken.org for the complete broadcast schedule. Thank you for listening.